does most of the most teaching here in Australia of my students. There's also Anya, but she always has to go back and forth because she's Dutch and she can't stay. So Philippa does the most of it. And so that's, I'm very happy about that. In Germany, I have lots of students teaching. Before I actually start on talking about the Dhamma, maybe telling you a little bit about what I do in Germany is interesting. I don't know, I keep it very short in case it isn't. But the interest in the Dhamma in Germany is overwhelming. Nothing compared to what goes on here in Australia. I haven't had an audience of 20 or 25 people in years. When I give a talk in Germany, it's more like between 200 and 800. I gave a talk the other day. Where was it? Where was I? Many cities everywhere. Oh, in Berlin, my hometown. And in a little theater. And it was sold out weeks earlier. They had to pay $10, 10 marks to get in. And it seated 600 people. And I gave a talk in Lindau, which is not far from Budahaus in the south of Germany, and also in one of those little theaters, and there were 700 people. And I quite often get invited to go to a bookshop, because that way they can sell my books better, naturally. And I don't mind, because I mean, after all, I've written the silly things, so they might as well get sold, you know. So they never have less than 200 people. And they're very keen for me to come, because that way they really sell the books. And so we go, I go when it's possible. It's, so the interest is enormous. I have also aroused the interest of the media to a quite a, well, to my mind, and quite an exaggerated extent. If that happened, would have happened to me when I was younger, I probably would have got conceited. Now that's out of the question. So it's a good thing it happens to me now. There was a, well, I've been on numbers of television shows, and whenever that happens, the phone at Budahaus rings incessantly, and my poor Gudrun has really to work her head off to try and send out the information to everybody. Well, we just had a show on the 16th of January. I wasn't there, but I have the video. It was sent to me. I have it here in Brisbane, of that television show. And it's a 45-minute, what they call a profile, on my life. And it's quite nice. My son had a lot of things to complain about, which he didn't like. He thought it was too many flowers and a bit of kitsch here and all that. But I think they did quite a nice job on it. Mm-hmm. And actually, it shows me at what Buddha Dhamma, the day before I left for Sri Lanka to be ordained. And that was the day of the wedding of John and, what was her name, Bridget. They're long divorced, of course. But anyway, that was the day they got married, and I was wearing a sari and long black hair. And then that was at the Wat. And then they also showed a photo of my kuti at the Wat in that television show. And so it's quite nice. I mean, the way they've done it, I thought it was quite clever, you know, using old photos and things. So since that happened, the phone has again been ringing incessantly. And not only that, but my German books have been selling enormously well. People order 30 and 40 at a time. Not people. These are distributors for bookshops. and they order 30 and 40 at a time and distribute them to the bookshops. And seeing I've put a lot of time and effort into these books, I'm very happy if they get sold. And also, at this time in my life, I don't feel so energetic anymore as I used to. I'll be 73 this August, and I've had 4 operations, so I'm not feeling... Well, I'm feeling all right. I'm not sick or anything, but I don't have a lot of energy. And so I use time for books, because I can reach a lot of people with the Dhamma then, with the books, even more than with the tapes. We sell thousands of tapes in Germany, and I'm not exaggerating, because that too is lying, exaggerating. So, we sell about 4,000 tapes a year minimum of my Dhamma talks, but even that doesn't go as far as the books, because people might listen to them once and then not again. Whereas with the books, they give them to other people, and they, I think they are very effective in really propagating the Dhamma. And in Germany, yes, in Central Europe, I would say, well, there's somebody in Holland, but there's very little Theravadan teaching. What they had until not so long ago has been Zen and, of course, Tibetan. Tibetan lamas are everywhere, but most of them don't speak a single word of German. And if they do, I don't understand what they're saying. Most of them don't even know English. And the Germans, although they all claim that they know English, don't really know English. They all think they do, but they don't really, unless they've been in England or America. You can tell by the books they pick, because we have my English books there too, but they never sell. They don't go anywhere. So the lamas are very... there's a lot of that going on in Germany and in the other countries around, like Switzerland and Austria. In Austria not so much, but Switzerland and Holland. And there's a lot of Zen. But Theravadan is markedly lagging behind. So when I arrived in Germany 6 years ago and started teaching the Theravadan teaching, people were very surprised, and it seems to really touch them, because it's, well, it's Western, it's very Western the way I teach, of course, and I'm born to the language. I was born to the German language, and the results have been really very fascinating. This new Metta-Vihara, this new forest monastery, I'd like to say something about that, because it's very dear to my heart. It's a 90-year-old vision by Venerable Nanatiloka. Venerable Nanatiloka was the first German monk, and he became a monk in 1903 in Burma, and he was a teacher of the Venerable Nanaponika. Nanaponika just died last year at the age of 93. And Nanatiloka always had the vision that he wanted to make a forest monastery in Germany. But two world wars intervened and never got around to it. And also he was interned by the British, because the British couldn't, although they had great freedom and could do what they like, they were still Germans, and they got interned, and Nanaponika did too, together with Lama Govinda, and they were all spending their war years together in these internment camps, and did most of their translations there. And so Nanatiloka has translated from Pali, he was a real Pali scholar, numbers of scriptures which have never been published, and I've made it my business to have them published in German. They won't be a great bestseller. They're extremely scholarly, and I don't think I'll ever read them. They're the Abhidhamma and that type of thing. But I think it was necessary, even as an honor to him and to the work he has done, that they should finally be published. So we have published his translation of the Dhammapada, which is very nice, and people do buy that. And it's published in a big volume and in a small one also that you can stick in your pocket, which is really nice. And we have published 4 talks of his about karma and rebirth. And we have now published the Abhidhammata Sangaha, which is, as the word tells you, Abhidhamma. And it's a sort of a compilation of 7 Abhidhamma books. The Pali Canon, which is the basis for Theravadan teaching, consists of 3 parts. It's called the T-Pitika. T is 3 and Pitika basket, 3 baskets. And that's the Vinaya, the rules for monks and nuns, the suttas, the discourses by the Buddha, and the Abhidhamma. Abhi is higher, Dhamma, higher Dhamma. It's a philosophical treatise on the suttas. And nothing of that has ever been translated into German, and these manuscripts have been lying around for the past 50 years. And so we finally got it published just 2 weeks before I left. It's something for people who really want to get into the study of it. He had this vision for 90 years ago that he wanted to make this forest monastery. It never happened. So now we're doing it. And I feel very happy about that. And I feel that I'll probably be alive long enough. In fact, I'm sure I'll be alive long enough to see the see it finished. It's we have 22 acres in Germany. It's hectares. I never quite know what it is, but it's 20 acres. Let's say 20 acres, and forest, and meadows, and a creek, and 11 bedroom house, which is a 300 year old farmhouse, which was transformed or changed into a small hotel and restaurant by the former owners, and they went bankrupt because they couldn't look after it anymore. They got old, and the bank made a compulsory auction at which we bought it. It's about half an hour from Buddhahaus in the south of Germany, in the foothills of the Alps. You're on a clear day, you can see the snow-covered Alps from every window. And it's totally isolated. You don't see another house. You don't hear any cars, nothing. There's no proper road. There's only our own road that leads to it. And yet it's only 20 minutes from the main town in the south of, in Bavaria, from Kempten, from the railhead. It's only 20 minutes to the railhead. So it's a beautiful location. And here in Australia, that doesn't seem so strange, because this is still a country where there's a lot of land available, even though it might not be in the right place where one wants it. But in Germany, there's no land available. It's overpopulated. And to be able to find a place like that, which is just exactly what we wanted, is almost like a miracle. And it costs a lot of money, of course, but we got it comparatively cheaper because it was on auction. So what is happening now, it's getting totally renovated inside, and in spring it will be renovated outside. And what the plan for it is, anybody wants to be monk or nun can come and first live there for a year and see if they really want to be it. And also, we offer the place as a monastery on time. So what I envision is that people can come when it's finished, for a minimum of 1 month. I don't think I need to set a maximum, whatever time they've got, to have a really retreat from the world. And as I say, we have 11 bedrooms there, so at the moment we don't have to think of adding to that, because I don't think there'll be that many people all at once. And we'll see what happens. So at the moment we have a lot of my students also working there for free, which is very helpful. And we have some real tradesmen that get paid a lot of money. And we have some tradesmen that are friends who work for very little. So it's we have about 4, 5, 6, sometimes 8 people working there at the same time. And it's all going on very well, and I think it will be very beautiful. In fact, it is very beautiful, except that it's not livable yet. It's still a bit of a mess. But so that is actually something that I'm extremely happy about, that this can come about sort of at the end of my life. And we were keen on it, but nothing offered itself. And then this happened. So these are the things that are happening in Germany. And of course, I don't know if you know, but some of you do. German is the language that is most spoken in Central Europe. It's not English. Everybody knows a little bit of English. They can all say, you know, what time it is and how to buy apples. But the language which is mostly spoken in the center of Europe is German. Dutch people speak German. They all speak German. The Swiss, the only real language that they have in common is German, because they speak different languages in Switzerland. Austrians, is their language is German. In Hungary, half of Hungary speaks German. In Poland, which used to be Germany, western part of Poland speaks German. So, and Germany is in the middle of it all, in the middle of Europe. So we do have a lot of people coming from everywhere now that the borders are all open. That also hasn't happened before. I mean, for you this is all far removed, isn't it? But Europe has been little tiny countries for ever so long. And it's the whole of Europe is, well, it might be the size of Australia, I'm not quite sure. But it's all divided up into different languages, different countries, different currencies. Wherever you went, you had to show your passport and get a visa and be asked a lot of silly questions. That's no more. You can, practically all the borders are open. And they're very diligently working on a united Europe, with one currency, and they'll never make one language. But the one most spoken is German. They'll never manage to have one language. But they want one currency and no more passports and visas. So that's really a great step forward in peacefulness, one can hope. And I was at a peace university in Berlin, which was a beautiful concept, didn't work out the way it was conceived, where everybody was talking about whatever it is that they're doing so that they could help peace along. But it's strange, because the people who were there and were giving talks were all fantastic people. There was Pir Inyat Khan, he's the head of the Sufi movement, and Raymond Panikkar, who's a very well-known religious philosopher, I suppose you could say. There were 7 Nobel Prize winners. Everybody you could find. Really. And still the thing really didn't get completely off the ground. And there was a lot of controversy about it too. So a peace university with controversy is a great pity, isn't it? Well, I said my piece, as usual. And I did the loving-kindness meditation, as usual. And, well, 200 people, 300 people listening, and I thought it was well worth it. And wandered around my hometown, which is the biggest building site in the world. There's no bigger building site than Berlin. There's building going on everywhere. It's quite amazing. And it was very interesting. And I thought it was, you know, well worth my efforts to go there. It was strenuous. It's very strenuous, but it was well worth it. So all these things are happening in Europe, and I think that they're promising. They're promising for a better, better world community. Although, what's also happening in Europe is, right next door to Germany, they're killing each other. There's a war going on. And they haven't been able to stop it. I mean, everybody has tried, and it's still going on. And sometimes they think it's a religious war, but actually what it is, it's more an ethnic war. They want to have their own countries. The Croatians and the Serbians don't want to live together. Same thing everywhere, all the time. So in spite of all these efforts that people are making, that is also happening. And that's the Dhamma, isn't it? We all have the good roots and the unwholesome roots in us. What I thought I'd like to talk... Sorry if I've taken up too much time with all these just news items. But I thought maybe it's interesting, especially for those of you who had come to Germany and been with me in Germany. It's more interesting for you. I want to give an overview of what the Dhamma contains. I've done that before, and well, obviously in 21 or 22 years of teaching, I've done all of it before. And sometimes I feel as if I'm a used up record saying the same things over and over again. But I have felt that this overview is quite important to give one, if one wants to, give one an insight into what one actually has to do in order to internalize the Dhamma. There was an interesting item, I'll get back to some of these news items again. There was an interesting item in the most prestigious German newspaper while the Peace University was going on. And this prestigious German newspaper, which is usually quite bland about religious things, said, well, even the Dalai Lama is always saying the same thing. Well, yes. Of course he is. I mean, what else is there to say? And then I said, you know, the bestseller of all times has been the Bible. And I thought the Bible had been translated into over 300 languages. But the people who were on the platform with me immediately interjected and said, no, 1,264 languages. I can't imagine, but anyway, I said, all right. And it's a bestseller of all times. It's the most read book ever. It's the first printed book. The first book that was ever printed, the Gutenberg Bible. And what happened? People read it, and then they say, oh yes, that's right. And then they go about their business with the same roots of evil as they had before. So whether the Dalai Lama keeps saying the same thing, whether the Buddha keeps saying the same thing, or at the tail end of all this, whether I keep saying the same thing, really makes no difference. One's got to do it. And that's the most important part of the Dhamma, that we have to do it. Each one for ourselves. Naturally, the guidelines that we get from the Buddha are extremely important. They are, so to say, the core and essence of it all, that we have those guidelines. If we didn't have those guidelines, we probably couldn't do it at all. I know I couldn't. I wouldn't have a clue. When I heard the Buddha's teachings for the first time, I thought to myself, that's right. That's something I really can do, and I can really try and follow that. Naturally, some things we can do on our own. We all have a conscience, and we can try and live with that conscience, and we do. But to go beyond that, we really need some guidance. But that's it. That's all it is. The Buddha calls himself just the shower of the way. We can believe what he says, we can disbelieve what he says, we can argue about it, we can write about it, we can learn it by heart, it doesn't make any difference. If we don't do it, it makes no difference whatsoever. And again, it shows that even there, where the teaching of the Buddha is well established, if the people don't do it, there's chaos, absolute chaos. So we have actually an advantage. We don't have an old established Buddhist tradition in the West. So nothing of what we hear about the Dhamma is sort of mechanical. All that we can latch on to is something that we may have felt within and then get it confirmed by the Buddha's teaching. And that way we have a better opportunity to really practice it. The practice of the Dhamma consists of three parts. Wherever you look in the Dhamma, it's always three parts. It's always Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Sila is moral conduct, Samadhi is concentration, and Panya is inside wisdom. The word Panya means wisdom, but inside wisdom is a better way of realizing what is meant. These three are always within every teaching the Buddha gave. And any spiritual teaching that doesn't contain those three isn't worth paying attention to. It's got to contain those three. It's got to contain moral conduct, the way we behave. It's got to contain the meditation, the concentration, and it has to contain the insight arising. Now, in the Buddha's teaching, we find it over and over again, and we can look at it in this way. Our moral behavior, our everyday behavior, the way we act with other people, is a foundation. It's what we actually found and base our life on. And if that's not in order, we can't go on. Because first of all, we'll feel agitated. We'll feel probably also some remorse, regret. Maybe we feel anger and hate towards some imaginary person who is supposedly the causation of all that. But if we get our behavior to the point where we can look upon it with equanimity, and where we can at night when we go to bed recapitulate the whole day and are quite contented with the way we have conducted ourselves, then we have a good foundation for our spiritual life. I often recommend that we can, in the evening, sort of make a balance sheet. We can do it in our mind, we can do it on a piece of paper, whatever we like. Some people like to use pen and paper, some people just do it in their heads. What went on all day? And whether all the confrontations that one has had, and everybody has confrontations, nobody gets away without them, whether we have mastered them, whether we were equanimous about them, whether we could be loving about them to other people, or whether we got irate and angry and upset and nervous and agitated and restless and worried, or whatever else have we done. And have a look and see what actually happened during this one day. And then, if we find any of the things that happened that we are not too happy about, which we think, oh, well, I could have done that one better, no need to blame ourselves. None whatsoever. The only thing that's necessary is to recognize. Recognition, no blame, change. There's nothing to blame. There's nobody there to blame anyway, but that's a later aspect of the teaching. But it's useless to blame, because blaming is also negative. And if we've already done something negative and then blame on top of it, we've got two negativities instead of one. And why should we blame ourselves? It's already happened. What we can do is recognition and then make a determination, saying, well, that one wasn't very useful. I won't repeat it. And instead, I repeat all the things which are useful. I like to compare that to a shopkeeper who makes a balance sheet in the evening in his shop and looks at all the things that were sold and that really went well, that people really wanted to buy. And then he looks at the rest of the stuff that's sitting there and been sitting there for weeks. Well, if he were to reorder those things that are sitting there for weeks, be very foolish, wouldn't it? So he's going to reorder those things that everybody wants. Well, what does everybody want? Everybody wants lovingness, helpfulness, a way of being together, which is harmonious. Well, we can reorder that without any trouble. But any of the other stuff, much better just to leave it where it is. But not blaming oneself. That's not the idea behind it all. It just is. And if we were to blame ourselves for everything we've ever done wrong, only in this one lifetime, we'd never get out of blaming ourselves. It's a futile assignment. And then if we add to that all the lifetimes we already had before that, I mean, it's just hopeless. It's totally hopeless. It's useless. So we just look at this one day and we see what went on. And if it all was harmonious and loving, and if our inner reality was one of steadfastness, patience, perseverance, giving, we're happy about it. And then we have a good chance in meditation. And we can look upon this whole thing as a foundation, a bridge, and the other side of the bridge, the goal. The foundation, this side of the bridge, is our behavior. The bridge towards insight is the meditation. And insight is where we're trying to get to. It's, so to say, the other side of the bridge, or the other bank of the river, as it is usually called. But if we think of a bridge, we can say we'll walk over the bridge and come to the other side of the river. Meditation is not a goal in itself. It's not a purpose in itself. It's a means. It's an absolutely essential means, but it's not the purpose of the whole Dhamma. The reason why it is an absolutely essential means is because it's the only way we can ever get from the worldly duality thinking to the higher level of consciousness, which is unity consciousness, which has nothing to do with enlightenment or insight. It's just a different way of having awareness. Here the word consciousness is being used as awareness. Now we know the awareness we have every day. We don't even have to talk about it. Everybody is other than we are ourselves. This is me and this is everybody else. And our optics seem to prove that. Everybody is a little lump by themselves. But that's just an optical illusion. In reality, we know already from our scientists that there isn't a single solid building block in the whole of the universe. Everything are energy particles that come together and fall apart. Now, if those scientists who formulated these words would have taken themselves as an example of that, they might be enlightened today. But what they actually did was, they just specified that that's the way it is in the universe, forgetting that they themselves are part of the universe, and are exactly the same, and so are we. Our optics tell us that we are all separate. And our ego illusion tells us the same thing. Because we have that illusion that we are a separate entity, it also tells us that we have to protect the special entity that we are. And that the special entity that we are wants things, needs things, is going to get things, is going to become somebody, is somebody, knows things, all sorts of ideas we have about the special entity. And in our daily life, that of course manifests in our duality consciousness that here's me and there's you, and here's us and there's them, and here I am and out there's nature, which is one of the reasons why we have played such havoc with nature, killing rainforests and polluting streams and all that sort of thing, because we don't realize that we are nature. We think that's out there and we are in here. Our everyday consciousness is always concerned with how am I going to do the best for this person? How am I going to get somewhere? How am I going to become that what I want to be? Even though we may not notice it, that we're doing that. It's always concerned with that. And because we can't be sure, we can never be sure that this I, this person, is going to get what it wants and get rid of what it doesn't want, we are never totally at ease. There's always unrest, there's a feeling of agitation inside, there's never a total peacefulness. And because none of us have total peacefulness, there's never total peacefulness in the world, because we are the world. One person that gains total peacefulness makes peace for the world. Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers. But you've got to have the peace within. You can't make it out there. You've got to have it inside. And most people are perfectly happy to agree to that. Even the United Nations have it in their preamble. But has that helped? Not much, has it? I mean, maybe a little, I don't know, but not much. I went there once in New York, 1987, to the United Nations building and gave a talk there. None of the big countries sent a representative to listen. Only the small ones. And I don't think I made any impression on them. But anyway, I tried. So it was very interesting for me to be there. It was most interesting. The way I got there was because the ambassador for the United Nations from Sri Lanka was a friend of mine. And so he invited me to come. Otherwise, I would never have got there. So this ordinary, everyday duality consciousness, everybody carries it around with them. Everybody knows that everybody's got it. And it's constantly playing havoc with our inner peace and inner joy, because we need something, we think, from outside that's going to make us happy. Something that comes through our senses. Either seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, or thinking. Something that's going to come in from out there and really make us happy. And it doesn't work. It never has worked and never will. Because even if we do and there's no reason why we don't, get pleasant sensations and pleasant sense contacts, how long do they last? They're all very brief, and we have to renew them. And so we spend time and energy, the whole world, everybody does, time and energy on getting the pleasures from outside to come in. It doesn't make us happy, it gives pleasure. And so, in order to find a totally different dimension of insight, we do need the meditation. Because that different dimension of insight will not come by itself. It is said in the scriptures that sometimes people have meditated in their past lives and they gain insight without meditating in this life. But these are rare exceptions. And I would think, that's my personal thought, that in this day and age of technology, which is actually our religious, such exceptions would be almost impossible to find. We have a technocratic society and not a spiritual society. And those people who really want to know the spiritual truths are still in the minority. I told you about a lot of interest in Germany, that 600-700 people come to a talk, but there are 80 million Germans. So there's still a minority, a great minority. And so we need the meditative mind, the calm mind, so that we can see something different, that we can have finally an experience of unity. When we get an experience of unity, we see the world in a different light. When the mind becomes concentrated, after it's been thinking and pondering and arguing and resisting and labeling and all doing all sorts of things which all minds do when they first start meditating, and it's finally given up all this and finally said, well, all right, then I'll get concentrated, it's too bothersome, and just do it, then we have that opportunity, the opportunity of having a totally different awareness. And that totally different awareness brings us to an understanding of a different dimension, which is always present, that different dimension. But we never relate to it in daily living. We never think of it even, unless we meditate successfully every day. And then, when we do, we can take that different dimension into daily life, which doesn't mean that we have to remove ourselves from daily living. Not at all. And it doesn't mean that we are disgusted with the world or anything like that. Because disgust is also negative, and negativity doesn't help. But what it means is that we see the things that are happening in the world in a different light. I very often compare it to playing with a child. I have ample opportunity at the moment to play with small children. I've got two grandchildren. One is 1.5 and one is 5. And so the 1.5-year-old, of course, likes to build towers with blocks. And gets quite irate when the tower falls together and it all goes to pieces. Because he's still fairly clumsy, that happens every time a tower falls to bits. So the child screams, obviously. What do? I try to soothe him and try to tell him it's not very terrible that the tower fell to bits, we can make a new one, and it's not so important, and we'll try and do something else. Well, that's the way we see the world when we've seen a different dimension. Everybody's trying to build towers, and everybody's towers fall to bits, and it doesn't really matter. We can soothe them, we can help them. We can try to show them how to build a better tower if they are insisting on building a tower. But we can also tell them, don't scream. It doesn't matter. There'll always be another tower. But the reality lies somewhere else. And this is how we take the different dimension of the meditation into daily living. And that means that all our confrontations that we have in daily living, and everybody has them, there's no doubt about it. If we don't have too many people that we meet every day, we have, don't have that many confrontations. But we always have to confront ourselves. There's always something going on inside. We always have to confront that all the time. So those things we see that they're just games. They're not the real thing. The real thing is further, beyond the Once we see a different level of understanding that we have that within us, we can relate everything to it. So now when we have unity consciousness, for instance, that means that we do not believe anymore in this optical illusion that we're all separate. Because in meditation we have actually experienced the fact that we're not. That there is one creation. And don't think of a creator. Just think of a creation. You can see that creation. All you have to do is look. It's everywhere. And we're part of this creation. And this creation doesn't mean that there are bits and pieces everywhere. It's one. And in meditation, we do feel that. We feel that oneness. And we lose the boundaries. The boundaries which we put around the body, and we also put around time. We have boundary in time. Past, present, future. Three types of time. And because we always have that, we don't live in the present. And when we don't live in the present, we don't live at all. Because what we're doing is we're trying to remember what was in the past, and we're trying to project what's going to be in the future, instead of living what's in the present. But if we live in this present moment, and this is another thing we learn from meditation, we actually become acquainted with eternity. Because each moment that we live is always a moment followed by a moment. And as we have each moment as our life experience, there's nothing else. There's no past, there's no future. It just is. And then we have lost the boundary of time, and we've lost the boundary of this body. And although it looks exactly the same as it did before, everybody looks the same as before, we know differently. And as we know differently, we can then use the Buddha's teaching to try and understand what he means by the fact that we're all living in an illusion of self. And the insight wisdom which the Buddha talks about, which is the goal of the practice, consists of three bits, three parts, three characteristics: anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, and the corelessness of all that exists. Now we can pick one of those three and investigate, but without having a feeling for the fact that the way we think in everyday life is too limited. Without that, our understanding of those three characteristics will also be too limited. They will be intellectual. And although an intellectual understanding is very helpful, it's much more than most people have. It doesn't change one's character. It's got to be an inner feeling. And when it becomes an inner feeling, that I am totally impermanent, absolutely transient, really translucent and not solid, there's no fear of death. And when there's no fear of death, there's no fear at all. Because that's what we're all afraid of. Even though we may not admit it, it doesn't matter. We're afraid of annihilation. whether we say we are afraid of men or women or dark or spiders or snakes or whatever we may be afraid of, doesn't matter. It's all the same thing. We're afraid of annihilation. And once we've seen that there's nobody there to be annihilated, all fear goes. And only when fear goes can we really live in a sense of peace and a sense of inner security, in a way of real lovingness towards others, because they're not other. They're me. Or they're as much me as I'm me. And only then comes there that kind of peacefulness that people usually look for in the meditation, and which we can get temporarily in the meditation, but solidly only when we have seen how very transient everything is. I always recommend that one should have one of those little clocks that move all the time. What do you call these things? These digital things, digital clocks. You look at it and you see everything moves. And we think the time is moving and we are standing still. What nonsense. We're moving just as much as the little digital clock is moving, right with it. And on an ordinary clock, you can't see it that well. I mean, it moves too, but it isn't quite as noticeable. But on a digital clock, you can't avoid it. And we move along. It's like sitting in a train, and you look out the window, and you think that the whole scenery is moving, and you're sitting still. The train's going too, isn't it? And you're moving with it. It's the same with the clock. We're moving along. And once you see that, and once you feel it, not knowing, that's the first step. We've got to understand it and know it. That's the first step, very important. But then when you feel it, then you feel everything differently. And as you feel things differently, you can actually let go of all the things within which are burdensome. You can let them go. Everything that one would like to be, that one isn't, or that one is and wouldn't like to be, or that others are and one doesn't want them to be, or that others are not and we'd like them to be. I mean, all these things that we all deal with all the time, huh? You know, we look at it and say, well, it's all moving. Next moment, they'll be different. And they will be. Quite certainly so. And when you have that overview, which is an overview, it's like a bird's eye view. You look sort of from above at the whole thing which is moving. It doesn't have the kind of sting that otherwise our daily happenings most of the time have for us. And why do they sting? Because we think there's somebody sitting inside that really has to be protected, that really has to have things the way we have figured them out. We have made an imaginary life for ourselves. We imagine the way things are. And because reality and imagination never meet, we can never be totally satisfied. We need to look at it and see, is it true? It's no use saying, oh yeah, that's all true, finished. Or saying, it's all untrue, that's not the way I am at all, finished. That's no good either. Neither the affirmative nor the doubt are any use. The only thing to do is to contemplate it. Really try to go inside and see, is it like that? Do I have that? Is the Buddha telling me how to get rid of these uncertainties, difficulties, fears, dislikes, reactions? Can I do it? And if the answer is yes, there's nothing else to do but practice. Practice is the only thing that really matters. Everything else is just sort of extraneous matter. But practice is the one thing that matters. So in the first instance, just to recapitulate, in the first instance, we see and look at our behavior in daily life and see whether we're satisfied with it and contented with it. We can't meditate if we're not contented. We would like to become contented because of our meditation, but we have to bring contentment to the meditation pillow. Joy is a very important factor, a prerequisite for meditation. We're happy about the way we have been going. And that's our first step. The second is to try to become concentrated. What do we have to do in order to become concentrated? Well, most of you know, you've got to let go of all that thinking. How do we do that? Well, by recognizing the fact that the thinking is the world as we know it. And we'd like to transcend that. We'd like to become aware of a higher dimension. And tell that to oneself again and again and again, until the mind eventually believes it. It's a very set in its habitual ways of thinking, but eventually it does believe it if it's told often enough. The same with the loving kindness. If it's told often enough to love other people, it finally says, well, all right, then I'll try. You know? In the beginning it says, oh, I can't love that person, impossible. But in the end, the mind sort of says, well, okay, then I'll give it a go. And it's the same with this, with the concentration. Eventually, the mind does become tired of all this thinking. It's very tiring. Thinking is extremely tiring. It's with dukkha. And no need for it at all. So that's our second step, to get the mind unified, concentrated, to have it in a such a way that you can't shake it. It becomes imperturbable. And the Buddha calls it also, when it becomes concentrated, malleable, flexible, and so that it can see further than before. And having done that, then we have a look. What we can actually see, which goes far beyond of what is within our optics, far beyond what is within our thinking, because it is an inner realization. And as we get that, our whole being changes. One can say that we are what we put our mind on. Well, check it out and see, where do you put your mind? That's what we are. And people, many people, quite rightly so, would like to be helpful to others. It's a nice thing to do, and it's very important. But we can only help others as far as we've already helped ourselves. Whatever we find within us, that we can give to others. You know, when the Buddha spoke, people were able to become enlightened hearing one Dhamma talk. We have his Dhamma talks. So it's not the words, is it? The Dhamma talks are there. They are translated into English, no problem at all. So it's not the words at all. It's what comes out of a person. It's that emanation that came from the Buddha. It's that emanation of each one of us that changes our surroundings and that changes the world. So if we would like to have a better quality of life for ourselves and for everything else that is around us, the inner change will do that. I think you've been patient long enough, listened long enough. If you have any questions, you can ask me questions.
Are you interested in that third state world you identified the first one as see and look and be contented? So the second one as strong steady thinking. What was the third state?
I'm not at the moment relating quite well to what you're saying. The first stage was moral conduct.
I don't know, not from the field as you must do the same when you told me about
meditation. Ah, okay.
I identified three stages. The first one you said was to see and look and that type of thing. The second one you said was transcending, does not go to the application of transcendence. But you said there are three.
Yes. And then you come to, I said, unity consciousness, right? Yes, yes. Anything else?
Isn't there, people that are aware of the spirituality and the minority, do you not think that they are becoming greater than
the moment? It seems that way to me, but I often wonder, because you see, I compare that to a doctor. A doctor sits in his office, and all he sees are sick people. So he must be thinking everybody is sick, right? And all I see are people who want to learn to meditate. So I must be thinking everybody wants to learn to meditate, you know, but it's not true. But truthfully so, yes, I am convinced, actually. I am convinced that there is an increase, yes. The numbers that I was mentioning in Germany, I have never met before anywhere, you know, that many people. And not that these people all want to practice. They come out of curiosity, too, you know. But there are more and more people practicing, that's true, but it's still not enough. Yes.
I remember what in Germany last year, he said at one stage that she comes to the conclusion after a lot of thinking that Nirvana equals God.
Mm-hmm. Well, not God as an anthropomorphic figure, of course. I mean, obviously, and I think most people who think about God and have a fair to middling intelligence are not thinking about a person there. Although, you'd be surprised how many people do. How many people do think about a personal God. But the word God is just a word, it's just a concept. And if you think of it as the underlying reality out of which everything springs, but which it can only spring out of it if there is the craving to be, which is creation, then we can come to that understanding that Nibbana is the underlying reality, but it can only be the personal manifestation if there is that desire to be. And that's why God is also equated to creator, but that's the wrong way of thinking of it. It is creation is there, but no creator. And if you think of God as the whole of it, everything, nothing excluded, universe after universe after universe, galaxy after galaxy after galaxy, nothing excluded, and not anything in it, only in it when it wants to be in it, when it wants to manifest, when something wants to manifest, and we come to Nibbana. That's Nibbana. Well, Meister Eckhart, whom I usually use as to quote from, said, God exists because a creature exists, which is a personal God, right? But behind God is the Godhead. And so he's using the word Godhead as that which is overshadowing everything, consisting of everything. And he also, one of his main teaching, or the main teaching, was to let go of the I, of the me. That was his main teaching. And if you let go of the me, then God finds room to be. As soon as you let go of me, God finds room to be. There's a very beautiful poem by him. And as soon as you let go of me, Nibbana finds room to be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. learned the writing of Chungmung Sungpa, he talks about this idea of basic goodness, that everyone has a basic goodness. Do you agree with that, and what do you think this basic goodness is?
Well, I don't need to agree or disagree, but I can just go back to the Buddha's words. He said we're born with six roots, three good ones and three bad ones, wholesome and unwholesome. The unwholesome ones are greed, hate and delusion, and the wholesome ones are love, generosity and wisdom. And all of us are born with all six. We all have all of them. Born when we appear out of the mother's womb, yeah, and it's our choice which one of these roots we strengthen, and which one of these roots we try to eliminate or try to minimize. If we become aware of them, that we do something about them, and if we finally come to the stage where we understand that, you know, it's all a mistake, because delusion is the mistaken view of me, then the hate and greed disappear, and then you have only the good ones left. So everybody's got everything. It's a choice we make. Now also these choices are karmic resultants. However, they're not fate. We have free will. We can choose. And so it's a matter of awareness. And people are terribly deluded sometimes to think what is good and what is not good, of course, because we don't see so clearly. But it's quite right, you know, everybody's got the goodness, but everybody's got the badness too, unfortunately. So, yes. Why don't people practice? Yeah, that's a good question. I'd like to know too. I don't understand it myself. It's effort. Let's put it that way. I think the main culprit is the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. You know, lie down and watch television or something like that. And you really are never comfortable. I mean, you're comfortable for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then you have to do something else, and you know, so. I mean, I can see it so clearly watching these two little kids, you know. It's really very enlightening. They've got all the dukkha in the world, and their parents try with all their might to reduce the dukkha, but no way, not possible, you know. There's always dukkha. Yeah, why don't people practice? It's amazing, isn't it? And you know, the most amazing thing that I find is that even those people who have had some success in their meditation don't practice. And that I find even more amazing. I mean, if you've never had a moment of concentration and then you get fed up and frustrated, I can understand that, right? You need a pep talk by somebody. But if you've been quite all right in your meditation, it went quite well, and then you stop. I don't understand that at all. I have no understanding why this happens. And if I ask the person who it happens to, they can't explain it either. So it must be that third hindrance, loss and talk. Yes. Oh, you mean because people's minds are so convoluted, they need something which is far more complicated. Yeah, well, they can read the Abhidhamma. That's as convoluted as you can get. There's nothing to stop them. It's all in English. It's available. Seven volumes of it. Yeah.
What you have in the Dhamma is not creation but happening. Happening is because of the anterior causes.
Mm.
If you look at those things like the universe and things you're talking about, it's not a creation that you are looking up, but simply a happening which is supposed to always change. So I think the word creation is somewhat unfortunate to use this reference to the Buddha, because the Buddha's whole idea was that there is no creation.
No, there's no creator. The word creation is happening. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing.
Except that creation implies somebody is an author of the creation.
No. That's the kind. No, I do it on purpose. Because I like for people to break through the kind of thinking that they have been doing because of, well, actually being brainwashed into that way. The word creation is a perfectly good word without a creator. When you think of it, that there is something created, which means it's happening. It's the same thing. It doesn't, you see, it has... The word God has a connotation. The word love is heavily, it has a really heavy meaning for everybody. A God, creation, creator. But it's not necessary. When we see the things as they really are, these are just words and concepts. And we can use them. You see, in Europe, where nobody's really a Buddhist, I only talk to Catholics, it's very important that you use their language and show them that it's the same thing.
Yeah, but that's also important, because I get it with it. The word God and the law of God might say perhaps the interpretation of God as a job of being or some such thing. But that is not the way that I read Jesus or Muhammad, they spoke for God. I think God was always an anthropomorphic person, you see, part of sitting up there in heaven.
Yeah.
And when these people use the same word to denote a different concept, they are really obscuring the meaning. I think they should use a find a different word or find a different word for their ground of being or whatever they use. Because that confusion is actually used by people who believe in basic religion and so on. That when they get into a corner, they say, no, no, we're not looking at the anthropomorphic thing. We are looking at this ground of being or that reality. But when they go into their churches and things, they forget all about that and they start praying to this being who is sitting somewhere out there. So
it's not my experience. Not my experience at all. The people who come to listen to me are totally frustrated by the church. They've had it. They don't want to go anymore. They have heard it since they were, as you say in Australia, knee-high to a grasshopper, and they can no longer stand it because it doesn't make sense. And if I am able to make sense out of their confusion, they are extremely grateful. They find that the greatest help. You have a different approach. You are what is known as a born Buddhist. And that is a totally different story altogether. That's totally different. I must say that in Sri Lanka, I was several times told that how could I know what the Dhamma is? I wasn't a born Buddhist. Well, it didn't bother me at all. But when you deal with people like I deal with who are, well, Catholics more so than Protestants, who feel guilty about having left the church and not going back there anymore and not making sense out of the whole thing and feeling pretty negative about what they've been told, they feel so relieved when they find out that actually it does make sense. All they have to do is practice and they'll find out themselves. It's a different approach. And I've never been Catholic. I've been Jewish, but even that was nothing. I never practiced anything. But I have the Western approach, you know, the non-Buddhist approach, so to say. And the Christian mystics, which I have read to some extent, have given me have given me an insight into the possibilities that exist in Christianity. They're there. Teresa d'Avila, Meister Eckhart, Francisco de Osuna, all these people knew exactly what was going on. They had exactly the right understanding. They used different terminology. So when you speak to people like I do, who use that different terminology but can't make any sense out of it, it helps them a great deal to find out that there is some sense to it. It doesn't take them back to the church. Not at all. In fact, it makes them more solidly grounded in practicing Buddhism. You see, I tell them also something else. I tell them that the word Buddhist and the word Buddhism was never used by the Buddha. It's a much later invention. The Buddha used the word practitioner, and he used the word Dhamma. And so it's not necessary to become a Buddhist in order to practice. And I've told them that over and over again. And you know, I have 150 or 160 people in a meditation course, and I give refuge at the end of it, and all 150 take it. After I've told them they don't have to be Buddhists, because that is what attracts them, that they don't have to. Because by the Catholic Church they were told they had to. Whatever it was that they had to, I don't know exactly what they had to. So it's a different thing. I don't tell them that they don't have to be Buddhist to make them find it appealing. I tell them that because I mean it. I have never said anything that I didn't mean. I can't do it. I really mean it. But it's a different approach. And this is probably the reason why I wound up in Germany. You know, because I have that kind of understanding. And, that makes sense? Yeah. And you know, another thing which irked me all the years has been, and it doesn't irk me anymore, but it used to. I used to listen to some Western monks, Theravadan monks, and they used to say, and I remember it like it was yesterday, although it's 10 years ago and more, they used to say that in Christianity there's absolutely no way that you can have any insight, because you always have to have this union and you have to be there, and there's always God, and so you can't ever gain proper insight. And it used to irk me, and I used to think that can't be so, until I started reading the mystics, the Christian mystics. I could never agree with that, feelingly, but I didn't know enough at the time to argue, besides what's the use of arguing. But I always felt something wrong there, that isn't right. All religions have the same goal. Now you see, for instance, Islam. It's a really militaristic religion, isn't it? But Sufism is their mystic part. And I'm real good friends now with Pir Inyat Khan. He writes me pages and pages of letter discussing the most, subtle mental formations and asking questions. And so I try to answer. And he has exactly the same goal that we have. And it's not like Islam at all. It's Sufism, you know. So if there is a truth, there's only one. There can't be many. There's only one. And I compare truth to to a mountain and to the summit. Truth is the summit of this mountain. Now you might decide that you're going to climb this mountain on the west side, the east side, the north, or the south. Doesn't matter. Whatever you happen to be told is the best way to get up there. But up there on top, that's it. And once you're on top, you see the world the same way everybody else does. It's on top. There are several ways to get up there, sure, because some people live in the west and some live in the north and some southeast. Several ways to get up there. I think the Buddhist way is the easiest and best way to get up there, but because it's so explicit, we know what to do. But that doesn't mean that the other ways don't get you there. They do. A lot of people are trying to what? Different mountains, yes. Well, they get confused, sure. Yes. Yeah.
We don't really know what our religion teaches.
That's right.
Because Christianity, if you read the 14th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John, the Lord Jesus said, I am in the Father is in me, and I am in you. You are God.
That's right.
But not many Christians ever read that bit. They just slide over. It's too difficult. But the whole of that chapter is the book, my opinion, the core of the mysticism of the Christian church.
You don't even have to read it. All you have to do is meditate and you'll know it. You know? But if you then read it after you've meditated, you think, oh, that's nice. They're even saying it, you know.
It's everybody, the militant Christians say that this is nonsense. They don't even read their own books.
Yeah.
They don't even follow their own math.
It will be summed up a dispute on the language of John's philosophy. The same people say that in the later theological work and their
own. But not a committed Christian.
Yeah, but the thing is that if there was a detailed method for people to follow, they would soon get to the understanding, you know. Okay, have we exhausted the questions? All right. We'll attend to the breath for just a few moments. Watch it going in and out of the nostrils to quieten the mind. And now imagine that you have a beautiful flower garden growing in your heart. The most gorgeous blooms, lovely aroma. All growing in the soil of a loving heart and tended with care. And as you find yourself in the flower garden of your heart, you're happy, contented, and you feel loving and caring because there's so much beauty within you. And now we'll make the most beautiful bouquet that we can think of. Different colors, aromas, different blooms, just as beautiful as we can make it. And hand it with love to the person sitting nearest you. and we'll think of our parents, whether they're still alive or not. And we find the most beautiful flowers in our heart and give them to them as a present. And we see the joy that this provides for them. And we think of those people who are nearest and dearest to us, those that we might live with, and for each of them we prepare a beautiful bunch of flowers out of our garden in the heart, grown in love, tended with care, and given as a present, showing that we feel our togetherness and want to make the other people happy without expecting to get anything back. And we think of our good friends and acquaintances and relatives. Everyone who comes to mind, and for each of them, we collect the most beautiful flowers we can find in our heart and hand it to them with love and care and concern for their well-being. And we can see that the more flowers we give away, the more of them grow in our heart. Now we think of those people whom we meet in our everyday life, people we work with, or neighbors, or people in shops, on the street, whoever comes to mind, who is part of our daily happening. And for each of them, make a beautiful bouquet of flowers, grown in love, tended with care, given as a present. To show our togetherness, to show that we're thinking of them in a loving way. We think of someone whom we find very difficult, whom we've been angry at, or who's been angry at us, or if we don't have anybody like that in our life, then someone whom we feel quite neutral about. And for this person also, we get the most beautiful flowers out of the flower garden in our heart and present them with love. And if there's been somebody who we've been angry at, we can feel the anger dissipating, the difficulty dissolving. Now we open our heart as wide as we can and allow as many people into the flower garden of our heart as possible. First, we let everyone in who is here. And each one can take one of the beautiful flowers as a sign of our lovingness. And we can see each time flowers are removed, we have many more growing because we give them away in love. And love makes them grow.